From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, calls on Congress to tackle gun control in the aftermath of the Santa Barbara shooting spree, as families of the victims demand action.
We don't have to live like this. Too many have died. We should say to ourselves, not one more.
Also today, the US congratulates the new Ukrainian president on his election win against a backdrop of more violence and bloodshed. And the Nigerian military say they know where hundreds of missing schoolgirls abducted by extremists are being held.
Good news for the girls is that we know where they are, but we cannot tell you. Okay, we cannot come and tell you military secrets here. Just leave us alone. We are working. We will get the girls back.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama has announced that by the end of this year, the American military will end its combat operations in Afghanistan. Once an agreement is reached with the new president of Afghanistan pending the runoff vote, the U.S. will transition to an advisory role. And by 2016, the U.S. will only keep enough forces in Kabul to protect the American embassy there. President Obama says now is the time for Afghans to secure their own country.
Starting next year, Afghans will be fully responsible for securing their country. American personnel will be in an advisory role. We will no longer patrol Afghan cities or towns, mountains or valleys. That is a task for the Afghan people.
Ukraine's Interior Ministry says Kiev's troops have regained control over the Donetsk airport in the east of Ukraine without government casualties. Armed pro-Russian militants have been controlling the airport since Monday. They say at least 30 activists died in the fighting. As Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow, a temporary ceasefire has been reached between the rebels and the government forces.
The mayor of Donetsk, Alexander Lukyanchenko, said that a temporary ceasefire agreement was reached with the government forces after the special operation of the Ukrainian army in Donetsk resumed on Tuesday. Representatives of the self-proclaimed People's Republic of Donetsk said over 100 people, including rebels and civilians, died in fightings in this eastern region since Monday. The Donetsk authorities report some 40 casualties and 43 more wounded. Ukraine's new president Petro Poroshenko said that the government would not negotiate with terrorists and that they should be dealt with within hours, not months. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Ukraine should stop the military operation immediately.
Voting in Egypt's presidential elections has been extended to a third day after the country's prime minister threatened to fine people who didn't cast their vote. Former army chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who toppled Egypt's first freely elected leader, the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi, is expected to win by a landslide. A convicted hacker has walked free from a Manhattan courtroom despite facing more than 20 years in jail. Hector Monsegur received a lenient sentence for helping the FBI stop more than 300 cyber attacks. Nick Harper has more from New York.
Court documents showed that Hector Monsegur had been involved in attacks on foreign government websites, but the hacker, turned informant, agreed to use his connections to lead the FBI to numerous cyber criminals, and in the process helped to stop attacks on the US Armed Forces, Congress, and NASA. Federal prosecutors praised what they called his extraordinary cooperation.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. American Special Operation Forces are attempting to build up small teams of elite counterterrorism fighters in four African countries. That's according to a report in the New York Times. The newspaper says the idea behind the secretive Pentagon program is to target Al-Qaeda and its affiliated groups, but it's struggling to get off the ground. Lorna Shattuck has more from Washington.
A senior Department of Defense official told the New York Times that the U.S. is spending nearly $70 million to help train a counterterrorism battalion in Niger and a similar unit in Mauritania, but added that the initiatives are still in the formative stages. The Pentagon's also set aside $16 million to train and equip two companies of Libyan troops. That previously involved some training at a military compound outside Tripoli, but that ended in August after militias stormed the base and stole hundreds of automatic weapons, night vision goggles, and vehicles supplied by the Americans. The training effort in Mali is also struggling as the country attempts to recover from a military coup. Nonetheless, this is a signal that the Pentagon is still focused on using local forces to lead the effort against terror groups in Africa.
And U.S. scientists have found the online encyclopedia Wikipedia contains errors in 9 out of 10 of its entries on health. They're warning patients not to use the site, which anyone can contribute to as a primary resource, and to always consult their doctor. Here's Rebecca Bowring from San Francisco.
The study in the Journal of the American Osteopathic Association looked at online articles for conditions including heart disease, depression, and lung cancer. Scientists found 90% of entries contradicted the latest medical research. They also say up to 70% of physicians and medical students use Wikipedia. Its open-source nature has raised concern about its reliability within the medical community. The San Francisco-based Wikimedia Foundation, which hosts Wikipedia, says efforts are being made to improve the accuracy of entries, particularly in health and medicine.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The US has congratulated Ukraine on its weekend elections, with the Obama administration saying it's looking forward to working with the newly elected president, Petro Poroshenko. The result came as further bloodshed and unrest erupted in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine, where dozens have died in fighting between troops and pro-Russian separatists. Concern also continues for 4 international observers who went missing in the region on Monday. Our correspondent, Natalie Fieri, was in Ukraine for the election and spoke to me earlier.
Some pro-Russian separatists tried to take control of the airport in the eastern city of Donetsk. Around 30 pro-Russian separatists were reportedly killed, but Ukraine's military is now in full control of that airport. But there have been several killings over the last few days in clashes between pro-Russian separatists and Ukrainian forces as those tensions continue in the east of the country. Now, Petro Poroshenko vowed to tackle the situation there. He said in a speech on Monday that he wouldn't negotiate with terrorists, as he put it, and he said that it would take a matter of days, not months, to deal with what he called anti-terrorist operations. He vowed that East Ukraine would not be turned into Somalia, as he called it. Now, also in that region, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe said that 4 of its monitors are missing. They were on a routine mission east of Donetsk, but hadn't been heard from since 6 p.m. local time on Monday. The monitors, all male, were Turkish, Swiss, Estonian and Danish. So obviously some concern about their whereabouts as well.
Natalie, you were in Ukraine during the election. Did that protest run without incident? What sort of turnout did we see? And what do we actually know about Mr. Poroshenko?
Well, yes, I was in Kiev, in the capital of Ukraine, for the elections. There, the process ran without incident. I spoke to some international monitors who said they were happy that the process was carried out in the right way. There was a really big turnout in central Kiev, people queuing for several hours to go ahead and cast their ballot, people saying it was one of the most important, if not the most important, election they voted in since Ukraine gained independence from Russia 23 years ago. And with Petro Poroshenko's victory in the first round, the first time that elections haven't had to go to a second round, it's really a sign of the fact that people want someone to take charge immediately and deal with the tensions in the country. Now, Petro Poroshenko is a billionaire businessman. He owns Rosshen, which is a very well-known chocolate company in Ukraine. He's also served in the cabinet. And people I've spoken to, I spoke with one person who was the former vice prime minister of Ukraine, says he is seen as a pragmatist, someone who can negotiate, someone who can gather support. So people seeing him as somebody at the moment, given the tensions in the country, as fit to deal with the crisis.
So how did the international community greet the vote? And in particular, what was Moscow's reaction to the election outcome?
Well, President Obama in the United States welcomed the move as crucial for Ukraine's future and its democracy and for the country to move forward. The elections were also welcomed by the European Union. Now, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that the question of a visit to Russia by Petro Poroshenko was not being considered and was not being discussed through diplomatic or any other channels. So that's a bit of a concern, because Moscow had said it would accept the election results and engage in dialogue with the winner. And Petro Poroshenko has said he wants to talk to Russia to end the crisis, but Russia has called on Petro Poroshenko to stop military operations in eastern Ukraine.
FSN's Natalie Fury. This is FSN Reports. The United States is reeling from a deadly shooting carried out near one of California's major universities, which left 6 students dead, 13 injured, and a community terrorized. The gunman, 22-year-old Elliot Roger, left a nearly 150-page manifesto and a series of online videos explaining his motivation for the killings, saying that repeated rejection socially and sexually had driven him to murder his classmates. In Washington, D.C., our correspondent Alice Olstein reports on how the tragedy is impacting the national conversation on gun control and mental health.
There were a lot of red flags in the years and months before Elliot Roger stabbed 3 students and shot 3 others. He was interviewed by police after trying to push women off a ledge at a party, but never charged with a crime. His family talked to the sheriff's department about his angry online videos, but they didn't search his weapon-filled room and didn't follow up with him. He was prescribed psychotropic drugs, but refused to take them. Then, on Friday, he carried out his long-planned killing spree and ended his own life. Richard Martinez, the father of one of the 6 victims, spoke at a press conference this weekend, placing blame not only on the authorities who missed the signs, but the loose gun control laws that allowed Roger to legally acquire his arsenal.
Why did Chris die? Chris died because of craven, irresponsible politicians and the NRA. They talk about gun rights. What about Chris's right to live? When will this insanity stop? When will enough people say, stop this madness? We don't have to live like this. Too many have died. We should say to ourselves, not one more.
After other mass shootings over the past few years, including others at school campuses, bills have been introduced to tighten rules around gun purchases by implementing more thorough background checks, among other measures. But so far, almost none of these efforts have been successful, in part because of the lobbying power of pro-gun organizations like the National Rifle Association. But Ladd Everett with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence says this time may be different. He says the tragedy has given momentum to the push for something called a gun violence restraining order.
Where if you had evidence that someone was clearly, someone has violent tendencies or is a danger to themselves or others, even if they haven't been committed to an institution, that you would have some intervention available to be able to go in and at least temporarily remove firearms from that situation. This is a case where that clearly could have worked and saved lives.
Bills to require gun violence restraining orders are now being considered by many state and federal lawmakers. Currently, most states only ban people from gun ownership if they've been involuntarily committed to a mental institution or found mentally disturbed by a court. The Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and other groups have long argued the law should go further.
There's a lot of good research out there that indicates to us who is more likely to be violent in the future based on past behavior. And it's not just mental illness. It could be alcohol abuse that you've had in the past, which does make you more likely to be violent in the future. Could be a history of, violent misdemeanor criminal offenses. Different things that are clear predictors for future violent behavior. Look to see traction on legislation moving that targets those populations and allows for some type of intervention to at least temporarily remove firearms from these individuals.
When Congress returns to the nation's capital next week, they'll face a full schedule with votes on budgets, student loan policies, and possibly immigration reform. But many lawmakers will now be pushing as well for policies to make guns less easily available to people like Roger. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
The Nigerian military says it knows where more than 200 kidnapped girls are located, but says it won't use force to rescue them. Air Chief Marshal Alex Bade said a military move would endanger the lives of the teenagers.
The good news for the girls is that we know where they are, but we cannot tell you. Okay, we cannot come and tell you military secrets here. Just leave us alone. We are working. We will get the girls back.
The extremist group Boko Haram kidnapped the girls almost 2 months ago. The development comes as extremist attacks intensified, with another 54 killed in separate incidents in northern Nigeria on Tuesday. FSN's Lorna Shaddock got the latest from our Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso.
Well, the spokesman for the head of the Defence Force, Air Marshal Alex Bade, has confirmed exactly what the Air Marshal has said at that rally in Abuja where he was seeing protesters, and that was that the military was aware exactly where the girls were being kept, the up to 300 girls being kept by Boko Haram in a very forested area just outside Chibok, between Maiduguri and the border with Niger and Cameroon in the northeast of Nigeria. So it's saying that they know where the girls are, but they cannot attack this area for the simple reason that the girls' lives would be put in danger. And that's where they're keeping the statement for now. And of course, whether or not that is a tactic to try and see whether or not there would be any response or movement from Boko Haram in that region is another fact. But ultimately, the Boko Haram forces on the border with Niger and Cameroon are very formidable, and even the Defence Force have been saying, and Defence Force members in that region have been saying, they cannot meet the potential of Boko Haram in that area by, you know, man for man. So it's going to take an extraordinary effort to try and get those girls out of there.
Indeed, as the Nigerian Defence Ministry is saying, they can't use force, and it sounds like that might be the truth, what other options are there open to them? Clearly huge international pressure on them now to do something.
Well, there were already earlier reports that the government had decided that there had been an offer on the table to release 100 girls for insurgents or for Boko Haram members that had been arrested during earlier raids on cities like Maiduguri in the northeastern Borno state, and that offer had been turned down at a late stage. And the president's office quoted as saying that they had decided not to take up that offer, and also that they won't be negotiating partial release of the girls. So exactly how the release of the more than, as we know now, more than 300 girls are going to be facilitated is anybody's guess, and whether or not the military really knows where these girls are is another question, because an analyst here in Nigeria has made it very clear that perhaps the military does not have the resources to battle Boko Haram in that part of the country, and that it might just be a ploy to try and get some movement of obviously a very large group of girls in that area, and obviously in order to try and find any movement that could lead them to the actual point of where these girls might be kept.
Gary Alfonso in Nigeria. Now, voting in Egypt's presidential elections has been extended to a third day after the country's prime minister threatened to fine people who didn't cast their vote. Former army chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who toppled Egypt's first freely elected leader, the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi, is expected to win by a landslide. Election officials in Egypt said fines of over 500 Egyptian pounds, that's about $72, would be enforced for non-voting. Bel Tru is in Cairo and began by telling me why the process had been extended.
We've seen people reporting from different polling stations across the country that there haven't been the length of queues that we have usually seen in previous elections or referendums. And this, of course, is of concern to the authorities, as high election turnout is a stamp of approval they need to prove that the last 11-month crackdown on the opponents to the military-backed government was in fact what the nation wanted. So I think a lot of this extension, and also the national holiday, is to allow people to come to those polling stations and bolster the numbers.
So why have so many people opted out of this voting process?
I've spoken spoken to a lot of observers who won't give me their numbers yet, as they said that, you know, it's impossible to say. You know, we've still got several hours to go. But there have been some people saying that you know, there was, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamist group of the former President Mohamed Morsi. They are boycotting. Mohamed Morsi's Islamist supporters are also boycotting, as well as some secular activist groups who have been targeted by the security forces in the last few months. But speaking to voters in the lines, they said to me that they believe it's more likely to be indifference from the nation. People know what the results are going to be. It is very likely that former Army Chief Abdel Fattah Sisi will win a landslide victory, and therefore lots of people are staying home as they don't really see the point in contributing. That doesn't mean they don't support him, but certainly when something is as inevitable as this, this means people are less likely to care and do anything about that.
So was there a credible opposition, an alternative to Sisi?
Well, Hamdine Sabahi, who's a leftist veteran politician, was the only other candidate, which is one criticism that people have had of this election. He has put forward an extensive 130-page electoral program, which really, you know, is a proper program looking in, you know, in the economics of the country. So in that sense, he certainly has presented himself as a viable option for the presidency and gone on campaign rallies.
So if international observers perhaps aren't convinced, what about domestically? Has there been any protest against these elections?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question, because actually there has been a strange quiet from the pro-Morsi Islamist supporters camps. We've had almost continuous daily or at least weekly protests across the country since he was ousted in July, particularly after the violent crackdown in August. But we've had a very relatively quiet few days, even though there was fear that there would be, you know, retribution from those groups. There have been, you know, a few small marches that have been documented, but otherwise, you know, the country has gone to the polling stations and it's remained quite quiet. So I don't know whether that's a sign that his support base has been sufficiently crushed by the authorities and are too scared to come to the streets, or whether they just feel that it's, you know, that it's not the way forward. But certainly it's been quite quiet over the last few days.
Beltrú in Cairo. And finally, today's FSN Spotlight on a very big day for India. Here's Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, the future of India under the leadership of Narendra Modi and the Hindu-dominated BJP. Mr. Modi was sworn into power in Delhi earlier today and controversially invited the Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif not only to attend the inauguration, but also to hold private one-on-one talks as soon as it was over. The image of the two prime ministers meeting and talking so soon after Mr. Modi's election has caused shockwaves in the region, given the decades of historic animus that exist between India and Pakistan, animus that was fueled by Pakistani involvement in the Mumbai terror attacks of 2008. So what does Mr. Modi's landslide victory herald for India and the wider world? Adam Roberts is the South Asia Bureau Chief for The Economist, and he spoke to the newspaper's Asia editor, Dominic Ziegler.
Well, this is a shocking result in some ways. Apart from Congress, which has dominated Indian politics since independence in 1947, there's been never one instance of a single party getting majority on its own in Parliament before. And he did it in a remarkable way. While he did get a lot of votes, he got 31% of the total votes for the BJP, that wasn't enormous. What was so clever and well directed by the campaign was to target those votes, to concentrate those votes in the seats that really mattered. He has by far and away blown the opposition out of the water and made this a referendum on himself and on what he could deliver for India next. He is such a dynamic performer, such a strong public figure, that the whole debate became about him. Crowds, I would go to rallies in Uttar Pradesh and other places, crowds would just chant his name. It would be Modi, Modi, Modi. This is not a vote for the BJP. This wasn't necessarily a vote against Congress. It was a vote for Narendra Modi.
And presumably that has big implications for how he's now going to govern.
Yes, I think it does have very big implications for what comes next. He will dominate his government in a way that India certainly hasn't seen for a couple of decades. The outgoing Prime Minister Manmohan Singh was a very, very quiet, passive figure, and he'll now be replaced by a rather dominant, assertive and energetic figure. People who are in favour of Mr. Modi compare him to a CEO of a company. Those who are more worried about Mr. Modi, for example, Muslim minorities in India, worry that he will become so powerful that he will override the sorts of checks and balances that should exist to limit a more presidential sort of figure from dominating government here.
But India is such a riotous, rambunctious polity. Can one man really rule it alone?
No, I think there's no chance that Mr. Modi can rule it alone, and I think we shouldn't be too worried at this stage that he's going to set out to weaken institutions dramatically, at least not at the start. He's a sort of figure who knows he'll be judged by his performance, by what he delivers, and he knows he has to work with others to make that happen. And so he has been saying that he wants a broad coalition of parties at the centre. He also wants to work with the chief ministers of the states. In India, the constitution decrees that a lot of policy implementation is done at the state level, not unlike the United States. So he knows, however popular he is, however strong he is, he can't be a dictator. India's democracy is far too strong to let that happen.
Now, we still don't know the makeup of his cabinet, but what do you surmise about it, Adam?
Well, we're expecting to see Narendra Modi probably do something not unlike in Gujarat. So I suspect we'll see a rather lean, slim cabinet set up with fairly young technocratic figures in charge. And we will see Mr. Modi very hands-on and his prime ministerial office far stronger than the previous one was.
And now let's just look ahead and guess what his priorities will be in terms of policy. I mean, the backdrop has been a slowing rate of economic growth down to about 5%. A year, half the rate during the boom years from 2004 to 2008. And he's promised to kickstart the economy again. What will he do?
I think what he will look to do is very quickly get to grips with the sorts of things that upset voters particularly badly. And while slowing economic growth is a big part of that, the most immediate pain came from inflation, the high rate of inflation here. But to get the economy moving generally, he needs to get investment flowing, he needs to get the banks sorted out, and his great priority has been to talk about infrastructure. He knows that one of the aspects of the Gujarat model, what he talks about his great success in running Gujarat for 12 years, has been getting the sort of access to markets that farmers like, the better quality towns that urban dwellers like, and all of that comes with better infrastructure. So more efficient and reliable power supplies, water supplies, roads, railways, all those sorts of tangible, visible successes, visible evidence of economic growth are the sort of things that he would want to focus on.
We know less about his views on foreign policy. What can you divine there?
I think his foreign policy will be directed first and foremost by his wish to get the economy going fast. And we know that he's particularly close to the Japanese. He had a long and very enthusiastic conversation with Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, this week, and talked about the wonderful relationship, the deep gratitude he feels towards Japan, and I think that reflects his wish to have very good trade and investment relations with Japan as well, which may or may not please the Chinese, who will be watching this relationship as well.
That's Adam Roberts, South Asia Bureau Chief for The Economist. And there's much more about Mr. Modi in this week's edition of the newspaper. He's on the front cover, in fact, and also online at economist.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports, coming up on Wednesday. As it's announced, thousands of US troops will remain in Afghanistan. We'll look at what else is on President Obama's foreign policy horizon. That's Wednesday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.